lawsuit of the Dow are the way which we suggested has some affinities, at least, with the Greek notion of the logos. Although, as we'll see later, the Greek notion of the logos in connection with history, the interpretation of history, has a number of different meanings. But at any rate, the early Westerners, the Westerners who went to China and had occasion to translate this notion into Chinese, used the term Dao to do so. And so it's from the term Dao that we get, as we said yesterday, Daoism, which is the body of beliefs or attitudes, theories that we associate with the teaching of Lao Tzu and Kuang Tzu, his great disciple. When the hour ended, I think we were suggesting that basically the Tao is associated with the idea of nature, which we then said is one of the central themes in the history of political thought, and the several meanings that this term nature has in the history of political thought. When the hour ended, we have stopped at the point where Lao Tzu was saying that as you move away from nature, the nature for him is interpreted in its primitivist sense. It's going to have a different meaning for the classical Greeks, but for Lao Tzu, nature means nature in the primitive sense, what man came out of, so to speak, not where he's going, different conception of nature. And the general argument of Lao Tzu is that the disorders of history, as we said, can be overcome only by a return to the Tao, which he identifies or tends to identify with nature. And then he elaborates that conception. And I want to treat some of the elements of that elaboration now for the next few moments before we wind up our discussion of Lao Tzu. And many of his statements sound paradoxical or even outrageous. The more arts and crafts men have, the more are fantastic things produced. The more laws and regulations are given, the more robbers and thieves there are. No, the more laws and regulations are given, the more thieves and robbers there are. This reminds one, to some degree, of St. Paul's statement. If you remember your scripture, St. Paul suggests that the law, in a sense, seems at times to stimulate the things against which the law is directed. We become aware of things because of the law. We become aware of robberies or offenses or sins, so to speak, in us. And Lao Tzu seems to have somewhat the same notion, although the implications are quite different from those of St. Paul. Now, because the more laws and regulations you have, the more robbers and thieves there are, the wise man says, the ruler says, according to Lao Tzu, inasmuch as I betake myself to non-action, the people of themselves become developed. Inasmuch as I love quietude, the people of themselves become righteous. Inasmuch as I make no fuss, the people of themselves become wealthy. Inasmuch as I am free from desire, the people of themselves remain simple. I think I suggested yesterday, if there's any one theme that runs through Lao Tzu, is it that it is that if we eradicate desire, which presumably has been the thing that pulled us away from primitive nature. We eradicate desire, then order in this is accomplished. Now Confucius' position on that question is going to be quite different. Now, the most astonishing thing, of course, for Western ears, at least for those accustomed to a liberal sort of interpretation, is that you accomplish simplicity in Taoism, and you develop simplicity and contentment by preventing education. Education, he sees as one of the root evils which disturbs the ordering, the possibility of ordering the chaos that erupts when we leave nature, when mankind leave nature. He says, in olden times, the best practices of Tao did not use it. The best practitioners of Tao did not use it to awaken the people to knowledge, but used it to restore them to simplicity. People are difficult to govern because they have too much knowledge. Therefore, to govern the country by increasing the people's knowledge is to be the destroyer of the country. And elsewhere, Lao Tzu puts it this way. He says, everything that grows may be traced to its root. In the root, you always find a tranquil state, and there you return to nature. To return to nature is to return to the normality of things. To know the normality of things is to attain wisdom. Not to know the normality of things is to encounter misfortune. And education, therefore, is one of the factors that breaks into normality, you see, and undermines it. And his disciple Chuang Tzu puts it this way. In the days when natural instincts prevail, men move quietly and gaze steadily. At that time, there were no roads over mountains, nor boats, nor bridges over water. All things were produced, each for its own proper end. The people did nothing in particular when at rest, as he goes on. But when sages appear, when knowledge appears, and notice the parallelism between this and the myth of the fall of man in Western thought. When sages appear, or knowledge appears, tripping people over charity and fettering with duty to one's neighbors, doubt found its way into the world. That is, with knowledge comes doubt, and with doubt comes disruption and the release of desire. You see, we become insecure as we move away from nature, and as we become secure, insecure, as I would interpret Lao Tzu, as we become insecure, we attempt to overcome that insecurity by giving full vent to our desire for power, desire for wealth, desire for education, even, and desire for justice. So that until we can eradicate these desires, you see, we cannot overcome the insecurity, and we cannot therefore live, as he puts it, normal. We're right in the center now, it seems to me, of the Taoist view of ethics and politics. And he attacks music, for example. Music is associated with civilization and gets you away from nature in particular. He says, with their gushing over music, he's talking about those who develop knowledge, and fussing over ceremony. The empire became divided against itself. And of course, he's referring obviously to the period following the beginning of the disintegration in 750 BC, although he's writing, of course, two centuries later. I suppose one of my favorite stories from the Taoist view of things is a story that is related by Chuang Tzu, the great disciple of Lao Tzu. It runs as follows. Chuang Tzu was fishing in the Pu River. Chuang Tzu was fishing in the Pu River when the Prince of Qin sent two high officials to ask him to take charge of the administration of the Chu state. Imagine he was here with a long fishing pole, sitting and meditating. Chuang Tzu went on fishing, and without turning his head, said, "I have heard that in Chu there is a sacred tortoise which has been dead now some 2,000 years, and that the prince keeps this tortoise carefully enclosed in a chest on the altar of his ancestral people. Now would this tortoise rather be dead and have its remains venerated, or be alive and wagging its tail in the mud?" "It would rather be alive," replied the two officials who wanted him to come and take charge of the administration of the state. "It would rather be alive and wagging its tail in the mud." "Be gone," cried Chuang Tzu. "I too will wag my tail in the mud." And he went on fishing. Now here you have Chuang Tzu close to the river and the fish. And you have the king, the ruler, you see, asking to become administrator of the civil society. The civil society embalms and kills, according to Chuang Tzu and Lao Tzu. And therefore you reject it because you'd rather be alive than wagging your tail on the banks of the river. I know no more dramatic statement, really, of the Lao Tzu social and political outlook than that which is reflected in this story. And it symbolizes the judgment of the Taoists that nature, or the way, is spontaneous and free. The way of nature, the way of Tao. Whereas civil society, as you move away from nature, you see, destroys spontaneity, and with the destruction of spontaneity, destroys life. And hence, if you see it in this way, perhaps you can have a certain kind of sympathy for the Taoist view as stated in this story. Although at first it seems very outrageous. Now, there is a picture of the ideal Taoist society from which I'd like to quote now. It's in the Tao of Duking, and reads as follows. And let me read the statement, and then I'd like to make a comment on it, what it seems to mean. In the ideal Taoist society, they have more utensils than they care to use. They do not risk their lives in order to emigrate to distant lands. They're not mobile, either upwardly or horizontally. They have vehicles both for land and for water, automobiles, but none use them. They think their food fragrant, their dress elegant, their home happy, and their customs enjoyable. Nations border upon each other so closely that their people can be seen by one another, and the barking of their dogs and the crowing of their cocks can be heard by each other. But still their people age and die and do not communicate with one another. Now notice there are several principles in that passage that I think are worth noting. First of all, they have the potentiality for making tools as you move away from nature, for developing technology. But they don't use the technology that they can make because they know that it's a corrupting influence. That's the first principle. Secondly, they do not emphasize social change or mobility, because this destroys any kind of order that through which you can overcome the chaotic factors represented by desire. And thirdly, they are satisfied with a restricted realm of action. That is, they're not trying to go into other lands and carry on commerce and intercourse of this sort, because this would be even more disrupting of the natural order that is associated with the Tao. Now, let's see whether we can make some comments on Taoism as an outlook, as an ancient Chinese political outlook. First of all, I should like to add that sometimes Lao Tzu is regarded as the first philosophical anarchist. This is not strictly speaking true, but he moves in this direction. It's not strictly speaking true, because he still accepts apparently some element of authority, but restricts it almost to nothing. Some element of social or political authority, but restricts it almost to nothing. In general, you see what he says is that as desire moves you away from nature, then you begin to get authority over men. And the further away you get from nature, the more tightly knit the authority and the hierarchy will be. This is the picture you get as you get away very far from nature. And what the impact of Taoist philosophy seems to be that you try to push back this line very close, at least, to nature. You have technology, but you don't use it. Thus authority gradually is undercut by your indifference to it, to the things that authority can bring. Authority can make you rich. No doubt, the fisherman could have gone to the capital and become rich and satisfied his desire for riches. But in so doing, he would be playing the role that the ruler wanted him to play, which was to move still further away from nature or the Tao. So he went on fishing. Likewise, Lao Tzu is sometimes called, as a matter of fact, I characterized him this way in something I wrote once in an encyclopedic article on the subject. I characterized him as perhaps the first pacifist. Now, this strictly speaking has to be qualified too. He recognizes the military as associated with authority, and is perhaps one of the quintessential exponents of the Chinese view, the traditional Chinese view, that the soldier is the lowest occupation. You see, this has been a very old tradition in China, that the soldier ranks very far down in the hierarchy of occupations, at least. position also. However, there is no place, as far as I know, in the Tao Te Ching in which he repudiates the military completely. You see, the peculiar thing about Lao Tzu is that you not only have to renounce the desire for wealth and for power and for education and even for justice, but if you become too set on, let's say, renouncing the military or renouncing authority, if you try to do it directly, that itself is a desire. And if, in other words, you try to conduct a direct onslaught on the military or on the principle of authority, this strengthens authority and the military, because it's an expression of your desire. And out of your desire, out of your agitation, even if you destroy the existing authority or the existing military system, you'll build a new one, you see, because the very desire through which you destroy it will set up new authority and a new military, so that you have somehow to combine desirelessness in general with absence of desire. That is, you have to couple it with absence of desire to destroy directly existing institutions. In general, I think, his position, although he is so paradoxical that I hesitate to generalize on him, but in general his position is that the best erode, you best undermine this movement away from nature by trying to ignore it. By trying to ignore it. Don't become excited about justice. Don't become excited about anti-militarism. Don't become excited about anarchism. And you're more likely to get them if you don't become excited about them.
No. I do have a little problem here.
Yeah, I have many. About the sin of pride. Now, the sin of pride has occupied a very crucial role in the history of Christian thought. And as we're going to see in medieval political theory, it's the fountain of the other six deadly sins. All the others spring from the sin of pride. And yet the problem for the Christian thinker in connection with the sin of pride is that you may become proud of your humility. That is to say, if you strive too much against the sin of pride in order to be humble, you'll take great, psychologically, you'll take great pride in your humility, and thus restore pride to its pristine place as the deadliest of the seven sins. Now, I think Lao Tzu has something of the same notion here, you see, in connection with desire. So you can't get wrapped up in a social reform movement either, for Lao Tzu. You see the point? You see why he takes this position?
Which, of course, is
so directly contrary, I suppose you could say, to the activist emphasis in Western political thought.
Yes.
Think of it as an order of thought in accordance with the system of logic. which he's very suspicious. He is part of the problem of the development here at the Young Nation, along with authority, along with war, and so on. Hardly in nature, I'm using nature out in the loudest sense of the term here, as primitive animal and plant life, rather than nature, but in nature. Or can man completely transcend nature? But when we come to the 18th century, you'll get some of the 18th century optimists of the Enlightenment, like William Darwin, who will say that man, in essence, can completely transcend nature. How? He'll eventually abolish death. Well, if there's anything characteristic of nature, is that things are born and die, and there's a kind of cycle of organic life. But some of the thinkers of the Enlightenment, they see no limit to the ability of man to transcend perfect nature.
Well, maybe that would just be a redefining of nature. I mean, man going ahead as part of nature.
Yes, but maybe a kind of paradoxical thing. But anyway, he rises so completely beyond nature in a primitive sense that he no longer shares with the beasts and the birds and the carrots. Birth and decay. This is abolished when you get to the end of the session. It shows how far a view of that sort is as compared to Dallas.
Nobody's talking yesterday.
Go for a coat or manage the response and wait and see whether she's going to slap him when he put his hand on her thigh. Ergo, it never happened. Now, I think in this regard, it should be very clearly and loudly stated that the hijacker is a very unmasculine person. In contrast to the pirate, whose exploits are well known. Now, popular myth has it that skyjackers are precisely 8 feet and 2 inches tall. In actual fact, they run about 5 feet 6 and a half to 5 feet 7 inches in height. They are smaller than the average man. In weight, they weigh about 135 pounds and again are smaller than the average man. Ergo, they are not 8 feet 2 inches tall. Now, also by popular myth, hijackers are political. That's why you never can get this damn thing negotiated. It's because of political asylum. Let me say that of the 20 men examined, not one of them was political in the sense that you and I mean it when we say hijacking is political. Most of them were so damned inadequate lifelong they didn't even really know there were two political parties around, or that there were opposing political systems. As such, they were as apolitical as any other blob of cheese. Now, a couple of them, though, were ultra-right-wingers, not communists, ultra-right-wingers, who had gone to Cuba to assassinate Castro. Okay, they're not 8 feet tall. They are not political. Now, something I hear every time I talk to a crew who gets hijacked is, man, that guy was smart. Smart, my posterior. They will run on the average about 20 to 25 IQ points lower than the dumbest man on the crew.
Yes, I'm with Alaska Airlines, Diane Peterson. Since the stewardesses are the first contact of the hijacker, you said that most of them had some sexual failure with the female. Since we are the contact of that hijacker, would we represent, since we do represent a failure to them, would we fail then as far as trying to postpone their contact with the cockpit?
Hostesses are probably the safest people on the airplane. These guys, as a group, have been female-dominated as long as they've lived, and it's surprising the number of them who have immediately responded to orders from the hostesses. The guy points the gun at him. She says, "Don't point that damn thing at me." He points it the other way. He already has betrayed that he's a failure. We've got a couple of those. We have the guy who kicked the cockpit door shut. By and large, the hostess can be an extremely effective figure. She is safe because she is a representative of Mama and generally of the little sister in whom they used to have a good deal of forbidden sexual interest. Such that in their whole mealy-mouthed existence, this is the first time they've ever made an aggressive act towards a woman. They have told me with great delight that they saw fear in the hostess's eye and that it was the first time that as a man they had ever scared a woman. But all they want to do with the hostess is to scare her. There is no hostility towards the hostess. As such, hostesses perhaps have more latitude to delay the hijacker in the early maneuvers than have the male crew, who are a little more detestable in the hijacker terms. There is a second factor that we've found has been real effective a number of times. Let's start with the fact that these are Mama's boys. Mama maybe used to fix them a sugar tip. You too young to know about that. That was a piece of cloth and a little sugar and a string tied around. The kid walked around sucking it all day. Most of us can become babies under the right circumstances. The average tough, cigar-chewing, hair-on-chest kind of man who gets a cold suddenly turns into a great big baby. He lies up in the bed and he just wants all the services. In psychiatry, we call this regression, that the man moves backwards from his more adult posture to a baby one. This happens more easily between a woman and a man than between a man and a man. As such, there have been hostesses who have babied hijackers to such an extent that they became great, big, soft babies and gave Mama the nasty gun. That the good actions of the hostess can do much to protect the male crew. And if she'll use her sex knowingly as a woman and not as a sex pot, she can play a huge part in reminding him that he's going to fail on this just like he's failed at everything else. And you're awful, awful sorry.
You said earlier about the males that were attacked by strong women. Now, how would they react to a stewardess saying something to the fact, "Well, you really don't want that gun, do you?"
That's a gentle question, and it's one that male crews should ask, too. It's one thing to say, "Give me that gun or I'll bash your head in." It's something else to say, "Look, I'm required by company directives, to ask you to surrender your gun, and I'll have to repeat this every 30 minutes. But we have hijackings that would have stopped if this had been done. At a certain number, these guys did it intending to fail. And if this had been a part of the routine in which the pilot or the hostess had said with no animosity, "Look, company rules require me to ask you to surrender your weapon. And I'll have to ask you again in 30 minutes. Are you ready now?" "No? Okay, let's go on. You want to go this way?"
Since you have talked to some hijackers, did any of them admit that if the stewardess possibly would have handled him in such a way, he would have never made it as far as the cockpit?
That if the hostess had managed them in a certain way, what?
That they would have never made it to the cockpit. They admitted that if the hostess would have just tossed them out of it somewhat, they would have never made it.
There are instances. The guy McPeak in Kansas City, shotgun in hand. The hostess told him to go to hell and kicked the door shut in his face. And he went back and sat down, pissed, fastened his seatbelt, and went on in. hostesses can get away with more direct defiance to the hijacker than any other crew member. They are safer than anybody. They can freely, and in various instances have freely been the most constructive one.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Carl Moss, I think that perhaps we would all like as much warning as possible if something is going on in the back of the airplane, and we in the cockpit would like to know about it before the door bursts open and hears the gun in our face. To kind of get us an idea as you were talking a while ago, instead of going along, kind of collect ourselves and decide what we're going to do when the door is going to come open and the man is going to come forward.
It would then be helpful to know if a sustained period of time was involved, what kinds of changes had happened inside other cockpits due to those specific pressures, and what might happen to yours. If you knew what changes could happen, you might be on guard against that too.
All right. I had decided when all this was going on, without any outside information like we're getting here, to tell my hostesses that if somebody came forward, threatened harm to them, wanted them to enter the cockpit for him, to remind him that the cockpit door is locked. Like you say, they study, they know that the cockpit doors are locked by law. So they look for a chance for somebody else to open the door for them or to order the girl to open the door for them. It works out real well. It has for me on a bomb threat over West Texas for the girl to say, well, the cockpit door is locked, but I will be glad to get it open for you. And I have told her to come to the telephone and to tell me to unlock the door. She's coming forward with some coffee. Now, this is a signal. Anytime she calls me and tells me to unlock the door for her, I know she's got a problem. She has not had to tell me that a man is back there with a knife at her throat, because if he is really one of these nuts, which all of them are on the fringe, and he thinks that she has warned me, he might harm her. So just she has told me that she is coming forward to unlock the door for her. This alerts me there's a problem back there. I have a peekaboo that I can look through. I can see what's going on. I can see if the man is armed, what he looks like, what's going on. Any kind of warning is better than none. Right. Just for the girls here, I would like to say that this works out real well. She hasn't said he has a knife at my throat. She hasn't angered him in any way. He thinks she's going along with him, and yet she has warned us in the cockpit.
Well, you're well aware of the fact that someday somebody may have a secure cockpit, in which case things are going to go along without it being open anyway. Now, understand, I know about 20 cases in definite detail, and an additional 20 that one way or another I've been able to get some information smuggled out or wiggle somebody in to do the study. So based on 40, which is about one-fourth of the cases, is where my opinion comes from. And there's the other three-quarters out there that I can't say about them, and I can't judge about them. I only tell you those I know about. Of those I know about, almost every one of them could have been kept out of the cockpit by the honest response from the hostess saying, look, I am not permitted to take you into the cockpit. I will be pleased to call the captain and explain to him what the situation is and have a crew member come back who will personally deal with you in this regard.
Productivity.
Let's also look at energy productivity or power productivity. I rather have energy up there. And the units here are dollars per kilowatt hour or per BTU or some other energy use. And this is a measure of the value added of goods per unit of energy used. This has been going down. And it's gone down more rapidly than labor productivity is going up. We could make some arguments. It would take about an hour, and we only have about 5 minutes. But we can show that the major way, at least recently, of increasing labor productivity has been to increase energy utilization per value of goods produced. That is, all efforts to increase labor productivity decrease energy productivity. And this again couples in with this curve that we saw here. I think one can go on beyond that and show that with the present economic structure that we have and the present industrial measures, that in fact you will increase productivity to the point that you're actually increasing unemployment. As you increase productivity per man hour, you of course decrease the number of man hours per unit of goods, and that in fact by going to a more energy intensive economy, we are displacing labor by energy at a rate that's higher than the at a rate such that the proportion of unemployment will increase. So we've got a little problem there. In fact, there are those who are now trying to make arguments, and they sound nice, but they're not ready yet, is that unemployment compensation and many of the welfare payments which result from not only being unemployed but unemployable should be directly charged to the energy producing sector. Well, we can go on. The last point is this one about the need to enhance environmental quality. And I'll talk about that on Monday. But just to kind of lead in, I'll make the statement that with the present fuels available and the present energy conversion means, points 1 and 2 on the list I had on previously are absolutely incompatible. That is, any increase in energy utilization carries with it a decrease in environmental quality. We do not have the means available to produce more energy without producing proportionately more pollution. And we'll leave that until Monday and we'll go at it on some way. Are there any questions? Comments?
What is the importance of Barry Commoner's book in the Closing Circle? Do you think that's a really radical change in an ecologist now saying that if we don't change the social and economic structure, we're finished? I mean, is that a major change in...
No, it's not a major change. The arguments are becoming more refined, but I think many of us have felt for a long time that was in fact the name of the game.
But nobody wanted to come right out and say that until they had to open the problem a little bit more.
That's right. Okay. Thank you.
tried to suggest a very rough chronology of the development of ancient China. And the breakdown, the beginning of the breakdown in the unity in the era of classical thought, which starts about 750 BC. That the last dynasty before the beginning of the chaos is overthrown in 550. So between 750 and 550, you have a 200-year period of disintegration. And then between 550 and about 332, you'll remember what we said, you have a period of severe disintegration, political disintegration, and it's precisely in this period that the classical epoch of Chinese political thought arises. I mentioned one of the ancient documents going back to the earlier period yesterday, and I think I misled you. I think I said perhaps it was dated from 1120 or so. Well, actually, it dates after 750. I speak, of course, of the Constitution of Chao. I made a mistake when I placed the 1120 on the board. This is the beginning, roughly, or 1121, of the Chao dynasty. But the Constitution of Chao perhaps is a product of the period after the beginning of the disintegration. Something lies somewhere here between 750 and 550 BC. And then we said that in this period, between about 550 and 232, you have the development then of the classical thinkers about politics in ancient Chinese political thought. Lao Tzu, Confucius, Sun Yung, each of whom represents a distinctive position about the problems of the time. But their teaching, we suggest, by contrast with the more discursive, what we sometimes call rationalistic teaching that we're going to discover in Greece, was, perhaps we might say, I think that when the bell rang yesterday, I suggested it tended to be aphoristic. And most of you know the meaning of an aphorism. An aphorism, we say, is a kind of sharp, pithy, to-the-point statement, you see, an assertion, in a way. So you have a series of aphoristic statements which you have to interpret then. The background or the framework for which you, in a sense, have to interpret yourself. And this is why it's very difficult sometimes in some of the classical writers to find a spelling out directly of what they mean. You have to get at their meaning sometimes indirectly by inference from the aphorisms which they offer. I suppose you could say this is highly characteristic then of classical Chinese, ancient Chinese political thought. Now this afternoon, or this morning, I'm getting absent-minded again. You know, that's an interesting question, absent-minded. I'm using it constantly, but where is your mind when you're absent-minded? Have you ever thought of that? We assume your mind is always attached to your body. I mean, that's our ordinary way of thinking. But when we use the term absent-minded, we made it in Australia. Your mind. If space has anything to do with the mind at all, I'm trying to get you to question our basic language here, because it's all questionable. We don't know what it means, some of us. And this is one of the difficulties, of course, about thinking, not only about political thought, but thinking about anything. And I sympathize with the ancient Chinese thinkers from that point of view. But I'm back to the main theme, having wandered off to Australia. I'd like to divide what we say this afternoon, this I like, first of all, to characterize the pre-classical thinking as far as we can do so by reference, remember, to the traditional documents whose titles I placed on the board yesterday, like the Book of Changes and the Book of History, which were edited way down here, but which date back from a much earlier period, perhaps before the 12th century, as a matter of fact. And then secondly, I'd like to turn to an examination of the characteristic views of Lao Tzu, Confucius, and Song Yong in their conceptualizations of the political and the ethical problem as they see it. Let's look first of all at the deposits, the main teachings of some of the more ancient documents before the classical period then. In one sense, I think you can divide those doctrines, because we don't have an indefinite period of time, into three kinds of documents. They may have been folk wisdom originally, and then written down. So often this happens. Or they may have been descended from a body of writers very early, or a group of writers. We don't know what their original origin was, but they become a part of the warp and woof of the tradition of the classical thinkers, you see, in this period. And so we turn then to some of the teachings, at least, in the Book of History, the Book of Poetry, and the Book of Changes. By the way, before I forget, one of the best translators, it seems to me, from the Chinese, one of the most beautiful translators into English of much Chinese thought is Arthur Wayland. So if you come across his name, I think he's highly respected as a student of Chinese literature from the viewpoint of translation, at least, and both the political literature and other literature. Now, what is meant by the first principle that we that comes down then from a pre-classical period? The theory of exemplary kingship. I like to interpret it in this way, that it means that the ruler, by his conduct, can shape the mass, or shape the society. He sets an example in a way. It's anti-law in the usual sense. It's not impersonal. If the ruler lives a virtuous life, his subjects will tend to follow. And this is going to play an important theme, an important role in the teaching of Confucius. It is as if we would say today that Richard Nixon, if he lives an exemplary personal life in every respect, could bypass the necessity for legal commands. So in a sense, it's a personalistic interpretation of rulership. Law is an impersonal thing. Thus the Book of History says in translation, the sovereign, having established his highest points of excellence, he gathers around himself happiness, and then diffuses it so as to bestow it on his people. As we'll see in a few moments in the biography of Confucius, there are legends about how Confucius did precisely this through example. In another passage of the Book of History, it is said that personal virtue is a key to good government. Personal virtue is likened to a stone, which if you throw it into the water, makes circles. And if the weight is heavy, the circles from the ruler and go out to the subjects, thus producing order out of the chaos that is characteristic of so much of political life. Now, a second principle that is suggested in some passages of these traditional documents is that of what is sometimes called peaceful penetration. Now, this is a phase, again, in a sense, of exemplary kingship. That is to say, the individual ruler becomes so virtuous and so exemplary that he attracts not only his own subjects, but the subjects of surrounding states. So those states join the state which is ruled by an exemplary king. Our one passage, for example, in the book, I think it's the book of history, says, the Lord of the West quietly pursued his course of virtue. See, the emphasis is on the quiet pursuit of virtue. And because he was so outstanding and so virtuous, to him many princes came to arbitrate their difference. And gradually then, the empire is enlarged, you see, not by force in this tradition,
but by example. Now this is going to play a role in the disputes
between men like Confucius and Sun Yung. This is part of the heritage upon which they're going to attempt to build. Now finally then, a third principle from these traditional documents, the theory of the rule of heaven, or some people put a divine law. Both of them are perhaps inadequate in trying to get at the original. Heaven is an impersonalistic conception of what perhaps in the West we would call God, but it's not quite the equivalent of God. It's impersonal. It presides over the universe. I think I suggested earlier that much very ancient political thought thinks of the political realm as being simply an extension of the cosmic realm, of the realm of the universe. And this seems to be true of much of the pre-classical tradition in China. It is that heaven creates all and rules all. And what the prince does, what the sovereign does, is dictated by heaven. The sovereign is the vicegerent, or the vice ruler, who extends the rule of heaven. If you connect that with exemplary kingship and peaceful penetration, you see, then when the king is exemplary, it's heaven being brought to earth, as it were. And the coherence of the body social, the political body, is a product of personal example. And it extends even into international relations, if this takes place. In the absence of an exemplary king, everything tends to fall apart. Now, one of the debates that you're going to have in classical Chinese political thought down here is precisely at this point. What is the role of the rule of law as over against the rule of personal virtue? This is a debate that continues among the three classical thinkers. Now, in the deposit that we have, or the tradition of the so-called constitution, which is after the 8th century sometime, these principles are to some degree reflected. I don't want to carry on this very much, but I think we ought to concentrate upon the classical thinkers, but let's notice some of the elements in the Constitution. document, a ruling document. By constitution, we simply mean principles of wisdom, presumably, that are inherited in from the period toward the close of the dynasty, you see, toward the close of the Tao period, rather, and in the last 200 years up. One principle is that the king establishes the state, distinguishing the directions and erecting the ranks, dividing the country and distributing the land, instituting offices and allocating duties in order to be the pole of the people. Well, you can see how this comes from the traditional conception. But it becomes more explicit. There is a doctrine of popular welfare associated with the Constitution, the so-called Constitution of Chao. And there are six principles, or what the translator puts canon in the Constitution. They might be thought of as principles for virtue, for the ruler's virtue. He is an exemplary ruler, in other words, who follows these canons. The first is the canon of government, advice about rule. The second is the canon of education. And it's interesting, there's a great emphasis in the Constitution on education. Because education, quote, stabilizes the state and cultivates the people. Without education, you cannot get political stability. There is the canon of ceremony. Now, this is going to play a great role in the elaboration of the teaching of Confucius, the canon of ceremony. Because with ceremony, this rubs us very in the wrong direction in the West, of course, when we talk about ceremony. Culture today, the people become cooperative and harmonious through ceremonies. In a moment, I want to show how Confucius emphasizes this position. The fourth is the canon of administration, as it's called. Rules for organizing the administration of a state. The fifth, the canon of punishment. And lastly, the canon of industry, how you enrich the people. And there are elaborate rules for educating the heir to the throne. And interestingly enough, one of the elements of education in the heir to the throne is music. I emphasize this because it's going to play an important role in the educational theory of Plato, too. Why such an emphasis on music in the Chinese tradition, for example? The argument is that a person trained in music will take on in his personal life and in his political relations the attributes of the music that he studies, so to speak. And what are some of those attributes? Moderation, reverence, harmony, constancy, love, and benevolence. Hence the importance of music education. I've heard students for a number of years now to write essays on music and politics, and they look at me with daring eye, because we don't find textbooks in American government dealing with that problem, and therefore it isn't politics. But there's a very old tradition, you see, both in China and in Greece, that music education, in Greece, of course, it's a very broad conception, the meaning of music. Music education is vital for political education. The state is regarded in this view as a great family, as an extended family. And and the ruler of the state has as one of his primary objectives, until continuing knowledge of the Constitution, top, the equitable division of the land so that all people will have access to the land. Note the history of China since, and particularly since 1949. One of the keys, of course, to the Mao's regime is land reform. It's a very ancient tradition in Chinese thought that he who controls the land controls the system of equity or system of justice, so to speak, in the state. And there's an elaborate treatment in the Constitution of Tao involving what is called the equitable distribution of land. Because China, until very recent days, has been primarily a peasant society. And therefore, land and its distribution becomes extremely crucial. Then, it is said in the Constitution, divide equally the land and make a census of the people so that both numbers are known, both the size of the land and the number of people who will have to share. To each lot of the first class land shall be assigned a family of seven. This is an attempt to distribute it equitably. The larger families get the bigger lots of land. And three out of the seven in the family have to be producers, have to be occupied in labor. The others can be dependents, the other four. To each lot of the middle class, that is the families of six, shall be a lot of a different size land, which will be sufficient for their support. And there's a clear third class with a family of five, to whom shall be carefully allotted a bit of the land. And so on down until you get, presumably, a family of two. And what you have, then, is a picture here of land distribution somewhat like this. You have a square. You'll get the various size families scattered around 7, 6, 5, each given a lot by the ruler, presumably, which is his to cultivate. And then you have a proportion of this section of land which is public land. And the public land, of course, serves the functions of the state. That is, it is producer, presumably, of products for public consumption is over against private consumption, you see. The Constitution recognizes the distinction today between what we would call the public sphere and the private sphere. And with this kind of a distribution of land, according to the Constitution, the wise ruler can secure order and peace. This is part of his example, which will attract his own subjects to him, and will attract others from outside so that he willy-nilly becomes ruler of a larger area. This is the way, in other words, to build harmony in the world as a whole without military conquest is the implication. It is an equitable distribution of land. Now, these are some of the notions, but not by no means all of them, no misunderstanding. They're very sketchy here. But there are some of the notions, then, that constitute the heritage of Lao Tzu, Confucius, and Sun Yang. And we now turn, therefore, to how the three thinkers grapple with the problems of order, so to speak. Because if you accept Eric Fogelman's thesis. See, I cited him earlier, Ardor and History. History is constantly tending to chaos, if you accept this view. Historical experience, the disintegration. The task of politics is to order the disordering effects of history, of experience. This is a perpetual task of politics. Now, what are the answers that the three ancient Chinese thinkers are going to be giving to this problem? Well, let's characterize them in general first, inadequately, and then look at them explicitly. Lao Tzu says, in essence, return to nature. Now here for the first time we come upon a vexing word. You could write the whole history of political philosophy in terms of this vexing word, nature. Still see it today. Pope says artificial methods of birth control are unnatural. Almost all systems of political philosophy have resort to the term nature. But it means different things to different thinkers. So keep in mind it has no uniform meaning. Either in Eastern thought or in Western thought. But Lao Tzu gives it a particular meaning. His answer is, then, to the problem of order, return to nature. And he elaborates. Confucius's answer, in general, is to regulate desire and emphasize ceremonies. To regulate desires and emphasize ceremonies. Lao Tzu goes much further in some respects than Confucius. He says abolish desires. Abolish desires and return to nature. Confucius says regulate desires and emphasize ceremony. Now what does Shang Yang suggest, broadly speaking? He says emphasize force. Force is essential for art. And force is the essence of law. Here you get the roots of one of the traditional theories of law. Law is force, which some students of jurisprudence will, of course, repudiate. And you begin to get the debate about the nature of law. What is law? You see, in Sun Yat. Now let's look at Lao Tzu then a little more in detail with his answer of return to nature and abolish desire, and then you'll get rid of chaos and establish order. We don't know too much about Lao Tzu's life, except the tradition is that he was a librarian, a very learned librarian, and that on one occasion Confucius is supposed to stroll into the library and check out a book and talk with Lao Tzu. I don't know whether this is true or not. Their answers, you see, to the problem of order are quite diverse. Lao Tzu is one of the most famous librarians in history, I suppose you could say, if he was indeed a librarian. And so the problem is, what did the true Lao Tzu say, and what was attributed to him by, for example, his disciple Tong Tzu, whom we mentioned yesterday, and his other disciples. And so what I suggest here may be partly them, and partly their teaching, and partly Lao Tzu's teaching. So this is always the problem of reconstructing ancient political thought. Now, the key to Lao Tzu is the Tao. hence from this word we get the body of teaching that we call Taoism. When early Christian missionaries went to China and had the problem of translating the scriptures, one of the puzzles they had into Chinese, one of the puzzles they had was how to translate John 1:1. You remember that passage in the Gospel according to John, if you recall your scripture. And the beginning of the passage in John reads as follows, you will recall. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Now, John wrote from a Greek perspective. But when the missionaries came to the problem of how to translate that passage into Chinese, what was the word they used? What was the term they used in Chinese? They used Tao. In the beginning was the Tao. And the Tao was with heaven instead of God. And the Tao was God, or was heaven, and came to dwell among us. What was the way that the sense of that passage was turned in to Chinese. So that we usually translate Tao into English, and it's an inadequate translation, the students of Chinese tell us, but at any rate, it's often translated as word. Thou the Word. It's somewhat akin to the Greek logos, which is indeed the original of the word word in John 1:1. The translation of John 1:1 is, in the beginning was the logos, and the logos was with God, and the logos was God, and the logos came to dwell among us. Now for Lao Tzu, word means essentially something like the way, the way. As a matter of fact, this is really what the translator said. You see, the word and way were sort of interchangeable, the way. This is the way it's translated. The way the term logos is put into Chinese is to suggest the way. And so the problem, says Lao Tzu, of art turns on how we interpret the way. What is the way? And he tries to elaborate that then as his standard for politics. Before there was something, there was nothing. He starts out with this enigma. Before there was something, there was nothing. Or he puts it in his graphic way. The significance of a piece of pottery lies in the empty space between the rims, not in the rim. The world arises out of nothingness. Before anything, there must have been nothing. Now you say, well, how in the world do you get an outlook from this? The answer is that if the world came out of nothing, the social world or the world in general, the way, the Tao, is to return to nothing. To return to them. Thus, in the classical Taoist work, which some of you may have read, Lao Tzu is supposed to have said, returning is the motion of God. Weakness is the appliance of God. All things in the universe come from existence, and existence from non-existence. Now he interprets existence as being desire. When a desire expands, this is the beginning, as I told you to say, translating into Western terms, this is the beginning of the fall of man. When desires begin, desire for honor, desire for wealth, desire for power, and so on. All desire. And the Tao commands a desireless person. If you can create desireless person, then you return to the Tao, and you have a natural order then that emerges, which overcomes the chaos, which is the product of desire. The chaos of history is the product of desire. The absence of desire, then, is the characteristic of men and societies who return to the Tao. Now, what does it mean, then, to repudiate desire? What is a desireless person? What is a desireless society? And here there are all sorts of paradoxes that you find in the Tao, his conception of the Tao. Note this passage, for example, which suggests simplicity, contentment, and non-striving. The disruptions of the social order come because people strive, because they have desires. And desires clash. And out of the clash comes chaos. And out of the chaos comes war. And out of the war comes destruction. And so the Tao of the King, for example, says this: blunt all that is sharp. Cut all that is divisible. Blur all that is brilliant. Mix with all that is humble as dust. This is called absolute equality. Therefore, it cannot be made intimate, it cannot be alien. It cannot be benefited, nor can it be harmed. It cannot be exalted, nor can it be debased. Therefore, it is the most valuable thing in the world. Now, its political application suggests that even the striving for justice is barred, because the striving for justice is itself a form of desire. This is one of the hardest things, of course, for Westerners to understand about Lao Tzu, in a sense. Now, all sorts of striving are barred in the return to the Tao. And notice these paradoxical statements in Lao Tzu. The more restrictions and avoidances are in the empire, the poorer become the people. The more sharp the implements the people keep, the more confusions are in the country. The more arts and crafts men have, arts and crafts are an exemplification of non-nature. The more arts and crafts men have, the more are fantastic things produced. The more laws, let me just finish this passage because it's a key one. The more laws and regulations are given, note this for the law and order people today, the more laws and regulations are given, the more robbers and thieves there are. Therefore, the sage says, this is my final quote, that inasmuch as I betake myself to non-action, the people become developed. Inasmuch as I love quietude, the people themselves become righteous. Inasmuch as I make no fuss, the people become wealthy. Inasmuch as I am free from desire, the people of themselves remain simple. Now, more explicitly, what does this mean in terms of political society? We turn to that question tomorrow.